Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
Bellerín, otro defensor, otro disparo. Monreal, gol. Marca el futbolista español. Marca Nacho Monreal. Pim pam pum.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, it is not a goodly morning, so...
Skip over that part of it,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah,
yeah. I think we should.
A stormy morning in your part of the world.
Well, yeah, it's on the way. It's certainly hitting the south coast of Ireland right now. And if people don't know what I'm talking about, there's an actual fucking hurricane coming towards Ireland. It's Hurricane Ophelia. I'm tracking it on this amazing weather site. It's called Ventusky.com, and it shows you the wind speeds and the strength of the winds and the cyclone, blah, 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 all the cool stuff. I'm watching it here, and it looks like it's going to get pretty bad. I suppose we associate hurricanes with the other side of the Atlantic, and we've seen the damage that they can do. But we actually have one. It's bananas to even think about it. So hopefully we'll get this podcast done and dusted and uploaded before the full force of the hurricane winds hit Dublin. But certainly people in the south of Ireland are beginning to feel it already. So fingers crossed, everyone stay safe. It's quite weird and scary, actually, to think there's a hurricane about to hit Ireland.
Surreal.
Yeah.
Surreal. Hopefully this doesn't become a kind of storm-chasing edition of the podcast where you're kind of running around town with a microphone. I mean, it is, you know, you can make light of it, but it is... pretty scary too. So
it's a fucking hurricane.
Yeah, I know.
A hurricane in Ireland. I don't know. The words just don't seem to go together particularly well. Like you would never associate them.
I mean, rain, sure. Wind, sure.
Yeah.
Hurricanes.
No.
Nah.
Not really. Not really. But you're going to be safe enough over there, I think. I'm looking at the winds and it looks fairly okay, fairly timid in London at the moment. 20-mile-an-hour winds, I'm just looking. And if I go to this fantastic website, just off the coast of Cork right now, there are winds of 123 miles per hour. So that's pretty...
Surfs up.
Yeah, surfs up. And apparently there have been some people spotted kite surfing. And amazingly, these people got themselves into trouble, dickheads. I swear to God.
Who would ever have thought?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wow, yeah, a hurricane. That would be a good idea, wouldn't it? Let's go out in a fucking hurricane. I suppose it could be down to people just not taking it seriously or believing that a hurricane could hit Ireland, but there you go. This is where we are.
I guess after the weekend, there must be a slight temptation for you to just kneel in the street screaming, take me now, at the storm.
Is yeah. I have thought about that, actually. One way of just putting an end to our suffering. God almighty.
Here we are again.
Here we are again and again and again and again and again. We've seen this film before, James. We have.
We have. Or is it a play? I mean, I know you tweeted over the weekend, one of our listeners, Rupert Gould, comparing us to a Beckettian duo. I mean, his most famous play, Waiting for Godot, two idiots waiting for something that never happens. It feels eerily familiar, doesn't it?
It really does, actually. Yeah, we should say thank you very much indeed for that review. That's is really very nice. He's talking about listening to the Arscast Extra, and he said, on the way past the Emirates, and I wonder how the ups and downs of the season often seem to mirror the roller coaster of our theatre down the road. The gallows humour all Arsenal fans will recognise, but also the hope, always the hope. Poor deluded fools. And he says, as with most great podcasts, the key is in the chemistry, and Andrew Mangan and James McNicholas are a double act worthy of Beckett. That is high praise indeed, is it not?
It is indeed. As Sammy Beckett said, nothing happens, nobody comes, nobody goes. It's awful.
There's another one here. Let me see if I can find this. I had it a bit earlier on, but... I definitely had it.
There's kind of too many. It's sort of, it's overwhelming.
It is a bit. This is from DOB66 on Twitter, at DOB66. He says, was Beckett anticipating the Arsenal's endless cycle? Ever tried? Ever failed? No matter. Try again. Fail again. Fail better. And then he puts at the very end of it, fail worse?
Yeah. We're finding ways. We're finding ways. We're nothing, we're nothing if not consistent in trying and failing again and again. Maybe not trying sometimes. I mean, it felt like
that could be
the
issue. Yeah, maybe try a bit harder. I mean, look, I'm never amazed at our ability to find a way to lose a game that we should win.
Yeah,
it's
we're resourceful.
Yeah, yeah, we know how to do that. We really do know how to do it. So.
It's what can you say? I mean, you would go away up to the international break with a decent little run behind us. What was it? 6 wins from 7.
Yeah.
We steadied the ship. I think that was the phrase I probably said about 8 times on last week's podcast. And, it'd be wrong to say that there was a huge amount of optimism among the Arsenal fans, but maybe a little bit of peace, quiet, sanity, and now the hurricane has descended, and it's, we've gone into a game and it's all just feels like we're back to square one, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and it's the kind of game that you really need to win to consolidate that little run that we were on. You go away, you have the internationals, you come back, and it's a tricky enough away fixture. But, let's not pull up fucking any punches here. Watford are an okay side. They're not anything more than an okay side with a couple of decent players and a good collective work rate and spirit and what have you. But that's what you expect from a team that's going to be a mid-table team. In the heel of the hunt, they're going to be a mid-table team. So you know what to expect. But you've got to be able to put those games away. You've got to have... I don't think it's really an issue of quality in terms of quality of players. And you can say, well, if the players were better, they wouldn't make the mistakes, or character is a quality in itself. And I get that. But I think it is. It's to do with this team's, I don't want to use the word mental strength or lack of mental strength, but it's to do with the character. And it's not just the team, it's the club, it's the character of the club. It's something that we've seen over and over again. In the last few seasons, and having spurned chances when they got their equaliser, and we'll discuss the nuts and bolts of it, there was no reaction from Arsenal. There was no, if you feel like you've been badly done or wronged in a game, and I think Arsenal were wronged by the penalty. I think it was an obvious dive. The referee fell for it. He gave the penalty. Why doesn't that make you angry? Why don't you try and react in a positive way instead of they're gripped by a fear, paralyzed by this fear, because they've been through it. They've been through it time and time and time and time and time and time again. And that is the default reaction to a setback is, oh, fuck, not fuck this.
Yeah. It's funny when you talk about the squad. 10 years ago, we were talking about, are there senior players around to hand down kind of the identity and the ethos of the team? And now the senior players in this team are ones handing down an identity of panic and resignation, and even the newer players become afflicted with it pretty quickly. I mean, did you see the conversation after the game between Troy Deeney and Martin Keown in the BT Sports studio?
I didn't see it because I just paused the television when the final whistle went, and on my screen there was Hector Bellerin walking away. I think I used a picture on today's blog where he's sort of pulling his shirt up over his face, but it was the back of Hector Bellerin, and you could see his number and the name, and I just left the TV on. I didn't see the conversation, but I've read the quotes. What did you take from it, or what did you think?
Well, one thing I was going to say is that the point that you made about when the penalty was given, there was almost no reaction from Bellerin or from any of his teammates, and while we're not supposed to say we want to see players haranguing the referee and up in his face, Martin Keown made the point, if that decision had been given against an Arsenal team with him in it, that the whole team would have been furious and saying to the referee, look, you've got this one wrong. And, you know, I can think of many occasions on which that was the case. I mean, think of that Old Trafford game, for example, when Van Nistelrooy hit the bar with the penalty. But and he also made the point of, you know, there isn't that kind of accountability applied to the team themselves. He said if Mesut Ozil had missed a chance like that in one of the Arsenal teams he played in, he would have had to answer to the rest of his teammates. You know, he would have had a shout from the midfield or the defence saying, you've got to put those away. Whereas it feels like there's almost a kind of lackadaisical approach among this Arsenal squad where it's like, well, you know, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. You know, another chance will come. And
yeah,
we seem to operate like that and it doesn't pay off. Accountability has been a big cultural problem at Arsenal for a long time, but I felt like this Watford game kind of provided that, a microcosmic example of that.
Really. Yeah, I mean, it's... you see what he said. I wrote about it a bit in the blog today. You know, I can't imagine another team being subject to that kind of criticism from a player or a manager, really. You know, it's one thing for a pundit to say, okay, Arsenal don't have any character, don't have any backbone or cojones, as he said. You know, you're just saying you don't have any balls. And it seems acceptable to say that about Arsenal. I'm not sure that it is. I'm not sure it's the right thing for Troy Deeney to have done. But, you know, you can't argue with the sentiment. It's very difficult to argue with what he said when the evidence of it is right before our eyes. That this team and Arsene Wenger's teams for the last number of years have had these issues with mental frailty, fragility, timidity, that they do lack the kind of characters that you need. When things go wrong in games, being part of being a good team is being able to cope with adversity. It's not being brilliant all the time, because nobody can be brilliant all the time. It's how you deal with the setbacks in a game or in a season that really defines you as a team. And this Arsenal side, as we've seen once more, you know, unless we're like a Goldilocks team, aren't we? It's got to be just right. The porridge has got to be fucking just right. Otherwise, it doesn't happen for us. You know, you talk about the game at Anfield, the 4-0 before the transfer window closed. And what? We couldn't go out and play because there were too many things going on. We were a bit worried about what was happening with Oxlade-Chamberlain, a bit worried about what was going on with Alexis. Are we going to bring anybody else in? Is the manager fully focused? Are the players fully focused? Oh, and we go out and play in a really, really pathetic way. And I think we saw yesterday on Saturday, you know, that it doesn't take much for these players to give up. That you've got to be able to do it for 90 minutes and injury time, and you've got to stay concentrated and focused, but they give up. And it costs...
You have to be professional. You have to be professional. And they struggle with some some elements of that. And that is... that is staggering, really. I mean, I know none of this is particularly new, but this is obviously one of, you know, for all our problems, one of the biggest football clubs in the country, in Europe, in the world. And these are athletes who have got to the very, very top of their profession. And yet they just sort of relinquish responsibility at key moments. And that can only be because of a culture of permissiveness where that is allowed and tolerated. Because, and you know, you're right what you say. People, Troy Deeney probably wouldn't say that about a Chelsea or a United or a City, partly because it probably wouldn't be as true, but also partly because of the backlash, because he'd have some sense of, well, if I do that, come back and go for me. You know?
Exactly. Next time I play against those teams, I'm going to get fucking booted up in the air. Who's going to do that? Which Arsenal player is going to do that?
Well, nobody. And it's exactly the same as what Troy Deeney's doing on the pitch. You know, he spoke about it. He comes off the bench. First aerial ball comes in. He thinks, I'm going to get up and I'm going to win this one at any cost. And it'll get the crowd behind me and it'll make a psychological impact on the match.
Yeah.
And he does it. And he knows that he can do that. And even if he does put an elbow in somebody's back, is he confident someone's going to come back and do the same to him?
I know what he's saying. But at the same time, you know, Troy Deeney didn't say anything about all the aerial challenges he didn't win. when he came on. You know, so there's a bit of fucking blown smoke up his own arse there a bit. But, you know, the main point, you know, he feels like it's okay to say that about fellow professionals, about Arsenal. And, you know, it is annoying, really. We become this... Again, like I said in the blog, this kind of circus where everything we do is a meme, or it's something to take the piss out of, or, you know, we get trolled for this or blah. You know, it's beginning to drive me mad. But ultimately, you know, I think it comes down to A, the manager, and B, the owner, and C, the chief executive. I think all three of these men are culpable to varying degrees for the state of the club and for permitting this club to be run the way it is being run, where players don't feel accountable, where they can slack off, where they can just not try as hard as they should and nothing happens to them. Nothing changes. It's difficult to watch. It's difficult to watch.
Well, it's because it's a question of what are the demands and what are the expectations. You know, Arsenal, we've had this kind of tricky start to the season. Our form's been terrible away from home. But if you look at the league table, we're sat in sixth. And to be honest, that's probably about par for what people would expect at this stage. And that in itself is a scary thought, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can say we're 9 points off the top, but I mean, that's an irrelevant number, isn't it? Because we're never going to be up there this year.
No, I don't think so. I don't think, you know, that's even worth considering. I mean, it's how you gauge your team, isn't it? How far are you off the top? And certainly that's how we've, you know, looked to gauge Arsenal down the years, because what we've expected is a title challenge. What the club have told us is that the top four is a minimum. That's the minimum requirement for this football club. We heard that time and time and time again when we were finishing in the top four and people were getting fed up because we weren't challenging for the title. But, you know, we're in a season now where we haven't won away from home. We've played four games away from home, taken 1 point, and that was at Chelsea, where we had to. We couldn't do anything other than play the way we did. We had to respond, you know. But in the other three away games, we've lost 4-0 at Liverpool. We lost at Stoke, despite dominating the game, and we lost at Watford in a game that we should have won and had chances to do so. And, you know, it's not as if we're losing the same way. Those are different ways to lose each time, but still we're managing to do it. And I think, it's just very difficult to see this team challenging for the top four. It's difficult to see them challenging for the title again in the near future. I don't know how that's going to happen. Well, I think I know how it could happen. I think we all know how it could happen, but we understand that it probably won't happen because it needs a new man. It needs something fresh. Because you know what happens is you can keep buying players over and over. Keep buying players every transfer window. Keep recycling your squad. Keep shifting players around. Change formations. But the problems remain the same because they all stem from the same man, from Arsene Wenger. And it's the same coaching staff and the same, you know. So unless you change that, it doesn't matter what you do in terms of players or how much money you spend, you're going to have these same issues. So what it requires is for a new manager to come in, root and branch, change. Manager, coaching staff, scouting staff, it's got to happen for something to be fresh and new and different at Arsenal, because it will just keep happening under Arsene Wenger. And I think this is why I talk about Kroenke being culpable, because he gave him the 2-year deal. Gazidis being culpable, because people say, well, at least Gazidis wanted change. Well, maybe he did, and maybe he is actually powerless, but he still picked up £3 million last year and went on a PR exercise, a PR rampage, you might say, when Arsene Wenger was given his new deal. He said Arsene Wenger is world-class in every respect. This was the best decision for the football club. And he didn't just say it on Arsenal.com either. He said it to Gary Neville on Sky Sports. You know, it's one thing doing it on the official website because it's a bit of PR, etc. But, you know, these guys are all part of the problem. And I don't know who's going to change anything.
I don't know who's going to change anything either, because like you say, so many of those people at the top don't seem to have huge personal interest in changing. You know, we know about the owner. We know he's happy with what's being delivered. The manager, of course, doesn't have any cause for wanting his position to change, seemingly. No plans on retirement or anything like that. And as for Gazidis, if he does want change, he either hasn't got the power or hasn't got the bottle to make it happen. It's a pretty bleak outlook at the moment. I mean, the thing is, how it's not very different, is it, to where we were a matter of months ago at the back end of last season? If you look over what we were saying on these podcasts or on your blogs or, you know, in the last few months of last season, we're all saying we need drastic change. And what happened with winning the cup final and the switch to the back three and the new contract just kind of robbed us of that opportunity. And now we're sort of back sort of roughly where we were. I mean, it's difficult to say. I don't think we're in any better position than we were before the summer.
Well, let's talk a bit about the game then. What did you make of the team selection, the absences of Ramsey and Alexis, supposedly due to training ground injuries? But any thoughts on that, or do you take that at face value?
I mean, I think you have to take it at face value, particularly in the case of Ramsey, because he's been a pretty integral member of the team so far this season. But I think the one thing I would say about Alexis and Ozil not starting is not being involved in the case of Alexis, I do wonder if that might have been 12 months ago. I guess we'll never know for sure, but it does feel like their status or their position in Wenger's plans is shifting slightly at the moment. So I do wonder if this had been game 12 months ago, would Alexis have been pressed back into action? Would Ozil have been afforded the start? I think there was also a slight sense of him wanting to reward Alex Iwobi for what he'd done in the last few weeks and being on a good run of form. And to be honest, I didn't have a massive issue with the starting lineup. I was pleased to see Per Mertesacker in there. I didn't necessarily think Arsene Wenger would give him the nod in a Premier League game. I thought that was a sensible choice. Elneny has been all right in recent weeks. Iwobi's been playing well. Welbeck was great before his injury. So, you know, I could see the logic in it, definitely. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any real issues with the team, to be honest. I think it was a team that was capable of scoring goals. Aurelio Gomez was certainly the busier of the goalkeepers, it seemed to me anyway. And I thought, you know, it was a pretty insipid sort of first half. There wasn't a great deal going on, but I thought there were a couple of bright sparks. I thought Iwobi was pretty sharp. He was working hard. And then we got the goal just before halftime, not long before halftime anyway, a corner, Mertesacker's header, great header, thumping header. So there was something to like about what happened on Saturday. But, you know, it's not unusual for teams after the international break to come back and be a bit slow in the first half of games. But I wasn't expecting Arsenal to be as bad in the second half as we were. Nevertheless, I think there were chances to, if not to win the game, to put us in a more comfortable position. We had two particularly good chances, I think. When Mesut Ozil came on for the injured Danny Welbeck, again, we don't know quite how long Welbeck's going to be injured for, but I guess it's going to be another 3 weeks, so probably till after the next international break before we see him again. Ozil played a lovely ball into Iwobi. Iwobi probably should have scored. It was a good save, though, by Gomez.
That was a good save, I thought. Yeah, I mean, he'd want to do better, maybe lift it, but he didn't do too much wrong in that particular instance, I thought.
No, maybe. And then there was the Ozil chance, which again, I think he should have scored that. That's the moment, I think, on which the game turned. And obviously, within seconds, they went up the other end and had a dive, and the penalty was awarded. And as we know, when Arsenal face a penalty, it's a goal for the opposition.
Yeah, invariably so. And Petr Cech's actually had a pretty decent campaign, but that remains a big flaw in his game. I mean, you can sort of put it anywhere. I can't even remember what Deeney did. He just sort of put his foot through it, didn't he? And that's all he needs to do, hit the target.
Yeah, I could go back and have a look at it, will I?
No. If you want to inflict that on yourself. But it was a clear dive. I mean, you know, I do have a degree of sympathy with the referee, because some players are pretty good at conning them in these circumstances. But yeah, it was a dive, and hopefully there will be at least some respective punishment. It doesn't help us out, I guess.
No, it doesn't. Here, I'm going to watch it again. Here, let me just have a look. Here he is, Troy Deeney, with his big arse and his big mouth, stepping up. Where does he put it? Checks jumping around. yeah, basically just to the left of the goalkeeper. If the keeper had stood still and held his arm out, he would have had a go. I noticed Cech tends to dive to the right a lot when he's when he's facing penalties. But yeah, there you go, 1-1, and then we, you know, we still had 20 minutes of the game to go. And what was, I suppose, frustrating as well was that just before Watford equalised, Arsene Wenger took Alexandre Lacazette off. Now, we had a discussion about this last week or the week before on the podcast about why he always seems to take him off. And, you know, I didn't think there was anything. I think we came to the conclusion there was nothing that sinister about it. He was just maybe easing him into action. But, you know, I'd like to start seeing him get 90 minutes. I'd like to see what he could do against maybe a more tired defence. I wonder, does it say something about his fitness? But, you know, when you need a goal, all of a sudden you need a goal and you've taken your record signing off and a clever striker. I didn't think he was having a great game by any means, but he wasn't alone in that, and he wasn't particularly bad or anything. It just, you know, it's frustrating when one of your attacking options is gone. And then your only other attacking option on the bench really is what? Theo Walcott, who could come on and get you a goal, but like...
Well, I think there's a bit of an issue there, because with Lacazette starting up top and with Danny Welbeck generally actually playing one of the more withdrawn roles, the change that keeps happening is Lacazette for Giroud, and Theo Walcott's just not trusted to play as that centre-forward. Now, they're such different strikers that I actually think that's presenting us with a bit of a problem at times. You know, if Welbeck was on the bench, say, and you were withdrawing Lacazette with 20 minutes to go and bringing Welbeck on, you would still retain a threat on the counter-attack, the speed of someone who can run in behind. You don't have to completely adjust your style partway through the second half to accommodate that striker. With Giroud coming on, I feel like at the moment it's just kind of interrupting our flow. And actually, Lacazette was one of our... I mean, new signings always get a bit of an easy ride from fans, but I thought he was one of our better players on the day. I thought he was good when he dropped deep. He was inventive, created a couple of chances. And yeah, I was disappointed to see him come off. And we didn't really... Giroud didn't really offer much, did he? We didn't give many the necessary service.
No, it seemed to me like it was a substitution for the sake of making a substitution, rather than one where, you know, designed really to change the game. He just wanted to give Giroud some minutes, and maybe felt like in the final 20 minutes he could use Giroud. And I can kind of understand that. But if we were chasing the game, if we were a goal down, and you're bringing Giroud on, I get it. But we were winning, and we were creating some chances, as we just spoke about. And, you know, strikers can find a lot of goals in the last 10, 15 minutes of games when defenders get tired, when the concentration goes a little bit, when the legs get a bit heavy. You know, they can take advantage of that, particularly someone like Lacazette, who's got really good movement and anticipation in the box, where you think about the goal that he scored against West Brom. You know, he was the first to react to that kind of a thing. So, you know, I don't think the manager's substitutions were in any way effective. Ozil obviously had that chance, and he created that chance for Iwobi, but after that was pretty toothless. Giroud didn't have any impact at all. And then I was screaming for him to get Jack Wilshere on. I wanted Jack Wilshere on, you know, in the last 10, 15 minutes, because, you know, it was a game that was there to be won from an Arsenal point of view.
Yeah.
I know we reacted poorly and we were hanging on a bit, but I think, you know, be a bit proactive and try and change the dynamic of a game. Bring Wilshere on. And then he was about to do that, and Koscielny got an injury, so he changed his mind and brought Rob Holding on. And you're thinking, well, hang on a minute. Why couldn't you still bring Wilshere on and just go to a back four? You know, he could have had Mertesacker and Monreal at centre-half, Kolasinac and Bellerin at full-backs. And you put the extra body in midfield, and Wilshere's got that bit of craft and creativity that could help get you a goal. So I thought his substitutions were poor, and they came back to bite us in the arse.
Yeah, and I mean, the final goal, I mean, you know, there was a few ricochets all over the place and cleverly sticks it in the net. There was something inevitable about it, you know. You could feel it coming because Arsenal's players in that last few minutes, and I don't know if it's down to the international break or down to psychological factors, they just seemed sapped of energy, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you look at the winning goal again, I mean, Mertesacker was pretty exhausted because his first Premier League start. There was a moment about 85 minutes where the ball was out of play or someone was making a change or something, and he was standing there, you know, the classic hands on the knees, I'm exhausted, trying to get my breath back kind of a thing. But if you look at the way the goal came about, you know, Giroud is in the right back position. That's the kind of position we put ourselves in because of the way that we played, the way that we invited pressure, because of how afraid we were. I mean, Watford dominated those last 20 minutes. And the ball ricocheting around. We made clearances. We didn't win the second balls. We didn't get to the second ball. When we did get it, we lost it again. There was a moment, I think, when Ozil let the ball bounce off his foot. And then, of course, there was the acres of space that Tom Cleverley was in to score the winning goal, when it was clear and obvious to especially Granit Xhaka. People have pointed at other players not doing their best to get back, and that's a fair point, but Xhaka was the closest man. He was watching. He stood watching as Cleverley waited for anticipated the ball coming to him. When it did come to him, he made no mistake because he was, you know, why would you from there? It's harder to miss. But that goes back to what we're talking about, doesn't it? About just not trying or not doing the basics.
Yeah. There was an incident just before that, actually, I remember, where I think it was a Deeney knockdown. A long ball up from Watford, he knocked it down. And Watford had, I think, Cleverley and Doucouré, two midfield runners, the wrong side of Xhaka and Elneny, you know, in between them and our back three. And they were just completely untracked. They had just run past the midfield without being followed. And it was a similar kind of thing to what we saw with the winning goal, rather. Xhaka just stood on the edge of the box and sort of let it unfold. And, you know, you can say, oh, well, he's got 10 yards to make up there. How can he do it? Well, he does it by following in. He does it by tracking his man. He does it by being switched on. I mean, it's difficult to forgive and understand that. I think the only thing you can say is that it's not an individual problem. It is a collective problem. There are so many players making these kinds of errors. I mean, errors is maybe the wrong word, just like a sort of lack of application.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you put that down to. And I guess it does come back to that thing of, well, what are the consequences going to be for it? Is he going to be out of the team next week? Is the manager going to come down on him? Are his teammates going to round on him? Probably not. You don't necessarily think they will. You think they'll just shrug their shoulders like they did when the penalty was awarded.
Because this is what it is. This is what we do. This is who we are. This is how we do it. And nobody seems capable or willing to change it. You know, it's I mean,
it is interesting, isn't it? I get no pleasure out of doing this, but if you think about the nature of a team like Tottenham, right? So only a few years ago, they were absolutely like the prime attraction of the Premier League circus. You know, they were kind of the lion tamers, if you will, the clowns, the top star attraction. They could mess anything up. They were kind of hysterical in that capacity. And while obviously they retain a bit of that, they're still Spurs. With a coach with quite radical ideas and fundamentally a new approach to things, they have managed to an extent transform that perception. Your idea of what a Spurs team looks like has changed quite dramatically in about 3 years. Whereas ours, I mean, if anything, it's embarrassing to say, but we are now taking that mantle, aren't we, as the kind of the neutral's funniest team to observe.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not fun to say, but we are becoming the joke of the Premier League, really.
Yeah, yeah, because, you know, if you kept, it is a bit like Sideshow Bob and the Rakes. I know we had this the other week, but
of course,
like,
yeah,
it's what it is. But as long as you keep stepping on the rakes, you're going to get hit in the face with the handle. and we continue to step on the rakes. You know, yeah, I don't know. I genuinely don't know what more to say about that team, that performance.
I mean, is it not a curious thing that for all these problems, I know the league table doesn't mean much, but we are on the same amount of points as Chelsea and Liverpool. Like, if our aim this season is to get back into the top four, given that it's kind of Watford who are keeping us out of it at present, it is not the sort of one slice of optimism that for all our issues, that door is still kind of open?
Maybe so. I mean, yeah, it's still early days. There's only 8 games gone. A lot can happen. There are so many points to play for, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think it becomes harder and harder even, to cling on to that bit of optimism, right? It becomes harder to do that the more things like this keep happening. Because you can only hear, we've got to learn from this. We've got to put it right. We've got to work harder on the training ground. We've got to, you know, reassess. We've got to, you know, all those learning lessons things that we hear. When it becomes obvious after a period of time that the lessons do not get learned, or they only are learned for a short period of time and then they become unlearned again. Because you can only see it happening. Like, I was cautiously optimistic going into this game because of the run that we've been on. And I thought, you know, we have consolidated. We'd had 4 or 5 clean sheets, I think, something like that. You're thinking, okay, they're slowly going in the right direction. It takes a lot more to convince us that we're going in the right direction the way we want to go, but win against Watford, and you've got another win under your belts. You move into the top four. You go ahead of Chelsea, who just lost at Crystal Palace. Go into the European game. Get more minutes for those guys who are sort of on the fringes. You know, get them more involved, and maybe get a good win against Red Star Belgrade. Then you come back, and who is it next week? It's Everton next week. An Everton team who've been dreadful, really, this season. And if you've got a bit of momentum going into that game, maybe you can do something about the poor record that you've got against Everton, Ronald Koeman, et cetera, et cetera. You know, then you've really started to establish yourself a bit of rhythm, and then they just fuck it up, and you're back to square one. You stumble again, and you've got to pick yourself back up, and you've got to get yourself going again, and you've got to learn the lessons, and you've got to, you know. Mm. So I don't know what my conclusion is, other than to wonder, are we all just fucking mad to try and make any sense out of something that we've probably made sense out of before? And we'll, you know, it's just so familiar. It's just so familiar, all of it.
Well, do we have to accept that this is... I mean, accepting things is a dangerous game, but do we have to accept that this is kind of where we are, that this is an Arsenal team who, over the course of this season, will lose games, that every decent run will be punctuated by a disappointing or sometimes even stupid result, because we are not a team of the calibre, a club right now of the calibre, to put together something more substantial than that?
Yeah. I think we do, probably for our own peace of mind, that maybe the benchmark for what we expect has got to be lowered. And if you lower your expectations, then maybe it becomes easier to deal with. I mean, I think the thing that struck me over the course of the weekend, and you know, from comments on the site, from reading what people have got to say on Twitter, is just that they're so bored. They're so bored of it all. Because of the familiarity, because they've seen it before, because we've lost that game countless times before, because we've done exactly what we did against Watford over and over again, that people are just bored. That was what I've seen people say so much on social media, on Twitter, on the site, in emails. They're just bored of it. And you couldn't blame them, really.
Yeah. No, that's it. And people go, you know, football's about more than trophies. And actually, I think what you're seeing at Arsenal is that borne out, because we have won some trophies. we have won some trophies, but we don't believe in the journey anymore. We don't believe in where we're going. We don't believe in the broader project.
Yeah.
And actually, that those fleeting successes don't mean that much when there's not sort of a light at the end of the tunnel, yeah. particularly.
Yeah, I don't want to downplay those because I think that, you know, you can't on one hand demand success and then downplay the achievement of winning trophies. But, you know, I think what it comes down to is the expectation levels that people have. And, you know, a club that says they want to challenge for the biggest prizes in football, yet manifestly refuse to do what you need to do to make that happen, you can't take them seriously. Because they talk a good game, but ultimately they just don't deliver on what they say as a football club. That's the manager, that's the chief executive, the owner. Well, he doesn't say fuck all, really, but, you know.
The fans are the last kind of element of the club with a title winning mentality,
yeah.
and aspiration. We still look at this team like they should be winning the league and pressing on to win the Champions League, but almost no other facet of the club is set up to operate in that way. And the dangerous thing is that you and I are talking now, saying, "Well, maybe we have to adjust our expectations. Maybe we have to accept this kind of top six, mid-table mentality in order to make what we're watching more palatable." And yeah. if that happens, then where are we then?
Mm. All right. You know what we're going to do? We're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll take your questions and more in part two right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer the questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thearsblog. Topical one to start with, James. Which Arsenal player, past or present, would be the most appropriate to name a hurricane after? Asks Dean Van Ngoyen. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Dean. Given the approaching hurricane in Ireland, which is getting closer, who would you name a hurricane after?
That's a really good question. I mean, I'd love to see the damage that Hurricane Aboué would wreak. But I don't know. Does anyone jump out for you?
Hurricane Merson, a load of hot air or whatever, something nice to do with the wind that he talks with.
Yeah.
I guess Hurricane Aboué.
Hurricane Merson would work, actually. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a few who seem pretty destructive right now. But Hurricane Merson would be...
Yeah, we'll go with that one.
A whole lot of hot air, not much more. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a really long question.
Okay.
It's from Charlie Les, who is from Toronto, living in Bogota, and a lifelong Gooner.
Okay.
He says, my question is this. Brace yourselves.
Okay.
Arsene Wenger seems to invoke the importance of the club's values more and more as the pressure builds for him to go, whether it be during disastrous transfer windows or the same repetitive failed campaigns in the Premier League. However, does Arsenal really have any distinct values anymore? Or is this just a smokescreen by Wenger to deflect criticism and pretend to assume the moral high ground? I guess what I want to know is, what are these values that Arsene seems to think he's instilled in the club? Is it timidity and parsimony in the transfer market? Players with no backbone instead of born winners who might rock the boat? Financial sustainability and subpar results over deficit-driven success? Loyalty to failed players, incompetent executives, and an underachieving manager and coaching staff season after season? To be honest, at this point, when he invokes the club's values, is it because someone is questioning his job performance and he's looking for shelter in this conceptual morass? What are Arsenal's values at this point in time? And how do they differ from other elite clubs in England and Europe?
Fucking hell. that's a question and a half, isn't it? I mean, what can I add to that, really? You know, I think if you talk about Arsenal's values, what could we say? You know, trying to give young players a chance, try and play nice attacking football. And that's kind of it.
Trying to do things the right way, like a sense of, you know, that kind of old marble halls etiquette, that kind of class about the way we do handle, I don't know, historically our
maybe.
Transfer business.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I think there is a... I mean, I think we try and think of Arsenal as an institution that will do things the right way. And I think they do many great things. You know, as a football club, you look at the work that they do in the community and they try and be inclusive, you know, with the outlook to fans from all over the world, you know, respectful of people's sexualities, their religions, their beliefs or no beliefs, whatever they might be, you know, to try and be inclusive as a football club. I think that, you know, those are values that we can get behind. But those are the values of an institution, and those are just values that people should share anyway because it's the right thing to do. It's not a uniquely Arsenal thing to say, you know, welcome on in everybody. You get that down every house in Ireland, they'll welcome you in and give you a cup of tea, but you know, that doesn't make it a unique thing for Arsenal. So I don't know. You know, you used to be able to pinpoint a style of football. This is the Arsenal way of playing. You know, under Wenger's best teams, that was something I think that we could cling on to. But yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, if Arsenal are a football club whose first and foremost value is that it wants to be a successful one, I think we could say that they're not succeeding in that regard. That I don't think the values of the club are so set in stone that we make decisions for the benefit of the football club above everything else.
Yeah. It is a troubling thing, isn't it, that Arsene Wenger, who spent two decades creating these values and this identity, they do seem to be eroding somewhat at the end of his tenure. Particularly that one about attractive football. I do feel like that one is, you know, that is a crown that we wore in the Premier League for some time. The team to watch, you know, the easiest on the eye, the most attractive, the most fun to watch. And I just don't think that, you know, I mean, you look at Manchester City, the way they are taking teams apart at the moment. We can't rival that. You know, I can't remember the last time we battered somebody like that. You know, it's tricky and I guess as a fan, it does leave you thinking, well, you know, what exactly am I backing here? What exactly am I, what am I proud of at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, I think the playing style thing is one that has, over the past maybe two or three seasons, become, I think, the biggest issue, you know, because I don't know that the manager quite knows what he wants anymore from his team and the way that they play. People say, well, you know, without Cazorla, we're lacking this, or without this player, or since that player left. But, you know, we've brought in big, big players, spent big money to try and fix all these things. And more I feel like I know less about the way that the team is playing football. It's just hard to know. I mean, what is our footballing style anymore? What way do we want to play?
Yeah, I couldn't describe it to you.
Yeah.
I couldn't describe it to you. If you said to me, describe Arsenal's style, what is their plan?
Mm.
How do they play? I could not tell you. And I, you know, you can blame it on the absence of Cazorla, but the great teams, and let's not forget, Arsene Wenger produced some great teams in the past. They had a style that was bigger than any player, and they had better players than we have now.
Mm.
But I remember seeing, you know, on Arsenal of 04, playing without someone of the magnitude of Patrick Vieira, and seeing people like Ray Parlour and Edu slot into that system. And because there was a clear approach, it worked.
Mm.
You know, it could still survive that. And Arsenal now, yeah, the fact that it all hinges on one Cazorla, it's like, well, whose style is it? Is it Arsene's style or is it Cazorla's style?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah, there's no identity. There's no, and that's Arsene's strength. That's what's always been his strength. His strength hasn't been to individually prepare players for every scenario. His strength has been to create a team philosophy that players can rotate in and out of, that they can move positions on the field. And it's overarching. And it's something that they all subscribe to.
Yeah.
And he has lost that knack. He has lost that knack. He does not seem able to apply that to the current squad and create a buy-in from them.
Yeah. Here's a question.
Go on.
There's a question here from Natalie Grover, who's at Natalie Grover, who says, are we ever going to emerge from our perennial existential crisis? Is this deep-rooted malaise fixable with a new manager?
I think, well, it has to be. It has to be, because that's the only that's the only real solution I can see. I would love to say that a new owner would be part of that, but I'm realistic about how plausible that is. I think it is fixable, but it will take a lot of time. It will take a manager, you know, he might be able to impose a new playing style upon the current squad, but it might take a lot of churn in the squad too. I suppose the one comfort is that maybe we are entering a period of churn. You know, we are entering a period of transition where our big players are going to leave, and if somebody new were to come in, they would have a chance to stamp their identity on the squad. But yeah, it might not be easy, but it has to be given a chance sooner or later.
Yeah.
Sooner or later. I mean, are you confident that a new man could change things?
Yeah, I think you have to hang on to that. You have to think that somebody
new. You have to, don't you?
Yeah, you have to, of course. I mean, I do have huge worries, and I know I've expressed them on this episode and previous episodes, that the way that the club is run and set up, you know, I feel like we miss a lot of football knowledge at board level. So I worry about who we will appoint. I worry about how much that manager will be backed. But you've got to cling on to the hope that a new man could come in and do something different. And turn things around. It might take some time, or it might take a second manager. It might not be the first guy we bring in. It might be the guy after that, or it might be the guy after that. But there has to be. See, who is going to say, James, this is what we want Arsenal to be. This is the aim. This is the ambition we have for the football club. We want to do this, this, and this. Now, how do we get there? What do we have to put in place to make that happen? Who is going to say that? Is it going to be Stan Kroenke? I don't think so. I don't think he gives a fuck what Arsenal is, as long as the value of his investment continues to rise. It's propped up by TV money. I just don't know.
Who that's going to be.
Yeah. Is it Ivan Gazidis? Is Ivan Gazidis going to say, you know, if Arsene Wenger's fired, are the shackles off? Will Ivan Gazidis become the buccaneering chief executive he wants to be, or we'd all want him to be? Is he going to put in place a 5-year plan to bring Arsenal back? Yeah, I mean, you know, I want a new manager. I definitely want a new manager, but I don't have an awful lot of faith in the other people at this football club right now to make the decisions that will get Arsenal back to where we want them to be. I wonder, James, if we've been through what will be looked back on as a kind of a golden era. And I know you could point to the second half of Wenger's reign, but, you know, the first half where we won titles, we won doubles, where those expectations were set and those standards were set, I wonder if we're going to reach those again for any sustained period without a period where it just we don't even get close.
I think you might be right. I mean, you know, I don't think it could get worse before it gets better, but I do wonder if, kind of for a supporter experience, the novelty of something fresh and something different and a sense of, well, we don't know how this journey ends, might make it a kind of a more engaging experience nonetheless.
Yeah. You know, think about the Europa League this season, which is the thing that I've enjoyed most. I know we've only played a couple of games, but they've both been enjoyable games just because they're different, because it's something different. We haven't seen it before. It's not where we want to be, but yeah, look, I think just from the point of view of having a different experience of Arsenal, a new manager is the first step. It has to be the first step. And then we see what happens after that. We see how these people run this football club. Maybe, you know, there's the danger that in some ways, as tedious and familiar and repetitive as it has been under Arsene Wenger, that there's a possibility that he could be the glue that holds a lot of things together. And without him, it could get worse. So it might get worse before it gets better, but I think just different is a point where a lot of people are. They want to see something different. They want to just experience something different. Look at the empty seats. You go to the games. You see empty seats. That tells you,
Well, look, talking of a new man, a new manager, there's been a lot of questions in the last few weeks about this, so I thought I should pose you one eventually. Magnus Holmberg tweeted in saying, if you were given the full power of Kroenke for 24 hours, would you try to recruit Ancelotti and move Wenger upstairs?
Well, no, I wouldn't move Wenger upstairs.
For one.
Ancelotti, maybe. I think he is a similar kind of a man to Arsene Wenger, isn't he? He's a nice guy. He's not going to put the players under a huge amount of pressure. There was a very interesting bit, actually, I heard recently. It was on the Second Captains podcast. I think it was Ken Early talking about it, about how Ancelotti is the perfect manager to come in to a club that has just been managed by Jose Mourinho. Because Mourinho is such a horrendous person and is like he's destructive in his way. You know, the relationships with players break down, that they then need somebody like Ancelotti, who's, you know, a good man, a good manager, a good tactician, but is not going to demand from them what Mourinho did. I think he might be the wrong person to come in and take over from Arsene Wenger. It feels to me like Arsenal need a manager who's a bit more like, I'm not going to say George Graham, but just that kind of a character, somebody who will be ruthless, somebody who won't let them away with the excesses, that they need a bit more of a disciplinarian, which Wenger isn't. Wenger is he lets them, or treats these guys like adults, like grown-ups, like humans. He lets them make mistakes. He lets them learn from those mistakes rather than sort of, you know, making them do 100 lines and correcting the mistakes so they never, you know, they're afraid to ever do it again, you know. It was like we talked about Eboué, but, you know, you remember Eboué's histrionics and diving and, you know, people, I remember hearing stories that, you know, coaching staff would be begging Wenger to talk to him about it, and he never did. Coaching staff would say things to him, but Wenger never said it to him because, you know, he'll learn from it eventually. So I think the squad's in a position where it needs somebody with a bit of strength, someone with real character to come in and turn things around. So
Ancelotti's an intriguing one. I mean, there was a time where I thought he was kind of a safe pair of hands, you know, to maybe succeed Arsene Wenger, that he was kind of a good bet for that kind of transitional period.
Yeah.
right now, I feel like what Arsenal miss so much is rigorous coaching. And I'm not sure Ancelotti is a coach. However, what I will say about him, as opposed to Arsene Wenger, is he has shown in the past a willingness to work with other people and absorb other people's ideas. You know, a manager who can kind of cope with the transfer interference he underwent at Chelsea relatively well, you know, since that he would be happy to work with, let's say, a sporting director, let's say a Marc Overmars figure or someone similar. He's always had assistants who have had good pedigree. I mean, Paul Clement, who's gone on to be a decent Premier League coach in his own right. You know, he thrived under Ancelotti, and Ancelotti was open to other people's ideas in that respect. So as a figurehead, as someone with the authority to kind of operate as an umbrella over people with more specialist skills, maybe he could be an option. Maybe he could be an option.
Maybe. And then, you know, you see people talking, I'm sure there are questions about Marco Silva. Is he the guy? You know, it's so hard to say, because we've seen managers come into the Premier League and do well and look good for a short period of time, but it becomes more difficult to produce that on a consistent basis. But if you go back over the last number of years and you look at the coaches that are out there that we could probably have attracted, you know, Guardiola in particular, I think, would have liked Arsenal and would have suited Arsenal very, very well. Just in terms of, particularly, you know, in the last few years where we were coming off the back of that Barcelona-esque tiki-taka, tippy-tappy style football that he could have come in and refined. You know, I think he's a one that we've really missed out on. But yeah, I don't know who it is. I don't know who it is. It's difficult, even with all the best knowledge in the world. You know, there's certainly no consensus among Arsenal fans. And you do wonder, again, I go back and I wonder what the fuck the people who have to make the decisions are going to come up with as and when that time comes.
I'll tell you what, I've got a question that I haven't necessarily seen asked that I wanted to ask you, which is that, in spite of the two-year contract signed in the summer, do you have any sense that we might be watching Arsene Wenger's last season as Arsenal manager?
I think if we keep losing games, then maybe. Maybe. Because the pressure will mount. Because, you know, ultimately the reason people are unhappy is because we're not reaching the standards that Wenger himself set. And let's make no mistake, they were very, very high. He did amazing things. But he himself is not able to reproduce what he was able to produce before. And some of it is because I think he's I think everyone's got a shelf life. Whatever their job, whatever their work, they've got a shelf life. And I think his is expiring. I've no doubt that he works hard and works even harder to try and recapture what he did in the past. But if we keep losing games, his position is going to become untenable. If we see players slack off the way they did at Anfield, the way they did at Watford, you know, the pressure will become too much. It will become too much. So it's possible. I think if we right ourselves and continue down the road and go on a cup run and continue to do well in the Europa League, then I think we'll carry on. But at the moment, like, I don't feel like the club have got any plan to make a change. But what happens on the pitch might force them into it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just something I was thinking about over the weekend, you know, talk of Overmars coming in for next season and Arsene Wenger's resistance to working with someone in that capacity in the past. And you know, the natural changeover in players that's going to occur if Ozil and Sanchez go. I just wondered if maybe some lessons might have been learned from what happened with allowing Arsene Wenger to run into the final year of his contract in the past, and if maybe the two-year deal might be a buffer and a bit of a bluff. But yeah. Maybe that's wishful thinking.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Here's a question from Matthew Celentano, I think, who's at Matt Selly. And he says, what should we do about Xhaka? I like him, but it's clear that his flaws are outweighing his strengths. Drop him for Jack?
Yes, Jack or Jack. I'm really disappointed in Granit Xhaka this season. I have to be honest, because last season I saw some really good performances, I thought, and I felt very encouraged and full of optimism for what he would produce this year. And I think, on balance, he has been well below the standards I expected. And when he's out of form, those flaws do outweigh the positive. I mean, I know he created a goal yesterday, and it was a brilliant delivery.
Well, it was a corner. It was a corner.
Yeah, but it was a good corner.
Yeah, it was a good corner, but, like, it's a corner. You know, sure. It's hitting hope, kind of, isn't it? And you're, you know, it's a good delivery, but you're dependent on someone else doing something, or you know, Watford doing something stupid, like asking Tom Cleverley to mark Per Mertesacker. So, you know, it's an assist, taking nothing away from it, but, you know, it's a corner. That's all.
Yeah. Well, that was all part of Tom Cleverley's evil plan to make us look stupid. But, yeah, and there were a couple of eye-catching passes, but they were relatively anomalous during that performance. And some of his flaws, you know, the big turning circle, the one-footedness, did stand out. I mean, if you're looking for a two-footed player, Jack Wilshere's not going to solve that problem for you.
No.
But, yeah, I can see why Xhaka is a cause for concern. And we spoke about, obviously, his reaction on the winning goal. I know, last season you were a big sort of proponent of Xhaka. You're a big fan of his. Are you revising that opinion at all at this stage?
Yeah. I think he's been really poor this season. You know, I thought last season he was subject to criticism that was over the top. And I thought he brought something to the team that we lacked. You know, the disciplinary issues were something, but I thought in general he was a tidy footballer, passed the ball well, gave us a bit of an extra passing range from midfield, but he's all over the place this season. I don't know what's wrong with him. His passing is poor. Like, he seems to have moments where he'll drill a ball out of play at least once a game. The mistakes that he made at the start of the season were punished very harshly with goals. You know, you think back to the game against Leicester and the game against, was it against Stoke? There was one against Liverpool as well. Liverpool. You know, so he has been poor. There's no point beating around the bush. Even if you like a player, you can admit that his form has been poor. And I think you're right in the sense that when he is playing poorly, the flaws in his game become much more obvious, or certainly less easy to defend. But yeah, I think he needs a spell out of the team. Simple as that. I think he needs to sit his arse on the bench and just think about what's going on, and maybe consider his application at times, because you go back to the winner at Watford that Watford scored, and I think he was dreadful. He's culpable there. He's not alone, but you know, he was a big part of that goal being scored. Who else do we have to bring in? I think Wilshere. Why not? Why the hell not give Wilshere a go? I don't know. You know, I don't know what else to suggest. You know, is it Coquelin? Do we go back to four at the back and put three in midfield? I feel like probably we should, to be honest. Just in terms of the squad that we've got, I think we will be better with an extra body in midfield than at centre half. And maybe you can bring Wilshere in alongside Ramsey and Coquelin. You know, it's not ideal, but at least you could see how those three things could fit together. Xhaka could fit in there as well. Elneny could fit in there as well. But
well, is that the thing with Wilshere? I mean, he was terrific in that Europa League game, but it was in a more advanced role. I mean, do you see him as an option for one of the two deeper players? Like, could you play a Wilshere with a Ramsey?
We've seen Arsene Wenger try and do that in the past, haven't we? And it's never really quite clicked the way that he wanted it to. Again, I just don't know what way we're going to approach our games or what we're trying to do. You know, because if we knew what we were trying to do, it might be easier to find a system that would work. But we don't quite know what we were trying to do beyond the very basic, which is win a game of football and score some goals. Are we trying to make ourselves more defensively secure? Not sure. Are we trying to play counter-attacking football? Not sure. Are we trying to set up a team that will dominate possession? Not sure. I just don't know what we're trying to do, so it's very difficult to figure out a way to try and do whatever that is, because I don't know what it is.
None of the other options are particularly hugely inspiring, but I do think that Xhaka sort of needs to be dropped almost to just, you know, help deal with this problem of a lack of culpability, a lack of responsibility for your performances, you know. I think he's been poor and there need to be consequences for that.
Mm.
Even if it is Francis Coquelin who comes in.
Well, so staying on this one, let me give you a question here. This is from Ben H.
Go on.
Who's at GunnerBen07, and he says, should we be concerned that we've had no goals from central midfield since Ramsey on the opening day?
Maybe. I mean, it struck me that, you know, Mohamed Elneny went close with a shot against Watford, and the commentator said, oh, he scored only the one goal for Arsenal in the Nou Camp. That was very early on in his Arsenal day, so he's not really someone you can rely on to do that. Xhaka, yeah, he's got a decent shot from range, but how many of those will actually find the top corner? Only a few. Ramsey's the guy. Ramsey, Coquelin's never scored for Arsenal.
No.
Jack's never been prolific. You know, Santi, a lot of his goals came from dead balls, didn't they? Penalties. I mean, he struggled from open play for a long time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all on Ramsey, really. It's all on Ramsey. And, yeah, maybe that is a bit of an issue. I mean, that we've been very reliant for a long time on Alexis Sanchez to score us goals, and then the centre forward, whether that be Olivier Giroud or Alexandre Lacazette, it would be lovely to think that would be spread around a bit more.
Mm.
But I'm not sure, apart from Ramsey, we have a player who's ever going to do that. I'm not sure we have a natural midfield goal scorer apart from Ramsey.
A sort of a Lampard-style player, somebody who can get you 10, 15, maybe 20 goals a season.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Ramsey could do that. He's done it before. You know, I think he's got the potential. But I mean, more when you look at other teams, you know, if you look at, I don't know, let's say Man United, like they would have Pogba, you'd think he might get you 10, and Herrera even might get you 10 goals. You know, City, you've got your Silvers, your De Bruyne's. There's a few players who contribute in that way. And Arsenal, it's sort of, from central midfield, it's Ramsey or bust if you're looking for a goal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So, yeah, it should be a concern then, I think. Is that what we're agreeing?
Yeah, I think you can add that to the list. Yeah.
All right. Have you got one?
Yeah, go on. Ross Creed at the Mighty Froosh says, does Andrew have an emergency supply of ham on Ruffles to keep him going during Ophelia?
Sadly not. Sadly not. I did have some ham on Ruffles last week when my daughter came home from Spain, but they're all gone now, so I've got no ham on Ruffles at all.
Have you got any kind of supply kit if it comes to it?
You know, we were only talking about that. Should we get some candles? What if the electricity goes out? I don't know. I don't know what the fuck to expect, given that, you know, in my lifetime, there's never been a hurricane in Ireland.
Sure.
So I really don't quite know what to expect at all. I mean, we've got food in the fridge, the brand new fridge that I had to get.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it was annoying. especially given that we went up, I think I put it on the blog, but I was trying to defrost the freezer bit.
Oh, yes.
And I hit it with a knife and cut a hole in
the
coolant.
You killed your fridge.
I killed the fridge, and we were up in the hardware place to get a new fridge, and sort of mentioned it to the guy that's how it happened. And he went, yeah, you'd be surprised how many men do that. So, you know, there's food in the fridge, and we've got water and stuff like that. But we have on the back of the house, we have a sort of an extension, which was poorly constructed. I think it would be fair to say the builders were absolute cowboys, and I'm a bit afraid that it might not cope with the storm winds. If they reach real storm force, I'm a bit afraid that the roof is going to come off that thing and end up, well, who knows where it'll end up. So if you're listening anywhere in the Kimmage area of Dublin, stay indoors, because my roof could be coming to break your house. Sorry about that.
Crikey.
Crikey indeed.
Well, look, sad about the fridge, but I'm sure you buried it in the garden, had a little service for it.
No, they took it away. Farewell. They took it away. Yeah, they took it away. I was like, no. Don't have that big of a garden anyway, so not big enough to sort of bury a fridge in, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right, I think that's... I don't know what else we can say.
I think that's our lot, isn't it? You know, we'll end on a somber note of the passing of a fridge.
Yeah.
Good luck in the hurricane, though.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate that. I'll keep you up to date. Unless, of course,
if
the roof lands on me, then, you know, we may have to reconsider. We do have a game this week as well, Europa League. And I'm just noticing here a story that Arsene Wenger could be in trouble. Did you see this?
No, what's he done?
He's had words with Neil Swarbrick, who was the referee. James Ollie in the Evening Standard reporting that he could face a disciplinary charge. He confronted the referee in the tunnel after the 2-1 defeat to Watford. He was left incensed by the decision to award the penalty. He's obviously got a bit of previous here. His Anthony Taylor indiscretion last year. I mean, not that any of us would have any problem with Anthony Taylor getting a bit, but, you know, it's a bit of a deflection, this one, Arsene. I can understand him being unhappy at the penalty, but, you know, it wasn't that obvious a dive until you saw a replay, was it?
Well, exactly that. I, you know, in the moment, I wasn't sure. That's when I saw the replay, I was sure. But
yeah,
he wasn't afforded that luxury.
Well, maybe Arsene Wenger will get a ban and it'll be all Steve Bold. See what Steve Bold... You know what?
Maybe
if
he's
he
the
gets
man.
A ban,
maybe he's the man.
Get Jens Lehmann in charge. Get Jens on the sideline for just a couple of games and see what the fuck happens. Jens Lehmann wouldn't put up with these fuckers.
He'd throttle them.
Yeah, he would. That's what they need. A bit more throttling from a German. So, yeah, let's see. Maybe it could be a blessing in disguise. Well, look, we will have a podcast on Friday at some point, but it will be post-Europa League, so it'll be... it should be. It's an away game, isn't it? So we've got 6 o'clock kickoff on Thursday, Red Star Belgrade. Let's see what we can do there.
Indeed. Let's see. Can't wait.
All right. I'm not crying, I promise. All right, well, look, I'll keep you up to date with the hurricane movements. Thank you, as ever, for listening. Thank you for sticking with us. We know it's not easy. We've been living this too, so hopefully we've... would you say we've brightened up anybody's day? I doubt we have.
No, but we've been there in their day, and that's something.
That is something. That is something.
Maybe. Not nothing.
Are we making it worse? Maybe we have to consider our positions.
I think they've all stopped listening. I think that, yeah. They just want to change. Something fresh, you know.
something different. Yeah, maybe we'll just
let Steve Bold present the podcast.
Yeah. Or we could just do the podcast in completely different accents next week. If you had to do the podcast in a different accent, what would it be?
That'd be my pirate Irish accent, obviously.
yeah.
The only one I can do.
That is your only accent, yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. We'll consider
well, look,
that.
We tried, guys.
Yeah. We did our best.
We really tried. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.